WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Welcome to WrestleSpective at FairToFlare.com. I am your host, Jason Mann, and my very special guest today is Qish of Qish Reviews. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing absolutely fantastic. Thank you, sir.
Welcome to the show, and we have a dandy to talk about today. It is the main event of the WCW New Japan Super Show from 1991. It is Ric Flair, the world champion, and we'll get into exactly what that means a little bit later, against Tatsumi Fujinami, the IWGP champion of New Japan. And this was a really, really big show, just as far as, you know, sheer crowd size. It was in the Tokyo Dome in Japan. Attendance listed here is 64,500. They mentioned during the commentary that's perhaps the biggest attendance that Ric Flair had ever been in front of at that point in his career. So quite a big deal.
Yes, absolutely right. It was actually, I believe at that time, the biggest attendance that had ever been in for any show in Japan too. I can't verify that, but off the top of my head, that sounds right.
Yeah, certainly, you know, I don't think there are many venues that are bigger than the Tokyo Dome in Japan. Of course, this was, you know, I mean, Japan, it's just a whole different animal as far as professional wrestling goes. And, you know, they had big stadium shows throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s, probably in the 80s as well, where, I mean, you know, it certainly a big show like this is probably a little more common than it was in the United States, where you get it, you know, maybe once a year with WWE. And that's basically it. You know, there's, you know, a couple of, there were, you know, New Japan, All Japan, and there were other promotions that would prop up, you know, pop up here and there that would do, you know, pretty big major shows.
Mm-hmm.
If I understand the landscape correctly, I'm hardly an expert in Japan, but
right.
You know, I know the basics anyway.
Yeah, you're pretty spot on. I mean, in the United States, it's mostly set around like the one big show every year, but in Japan, it would be more events that were built around one match, and it's just anytime they went to the Tokyo Dome, that was the big show, and everyone would come.
Right. Okay. So, you know, the big match, obviously the main event of this show, Fujinami and Flair. I think most of our audience knows what a big deal Ric Flair is, but how big of a deal is Tatsumi Fujinami in, you know, in Japanese wrestling?
Well, he's not one of the, like, top-level names, you mean, you know, up there with, like, your Kobashi and your Inoki and everything, but there's a lot of really significant things about Fujinami. The first one was, I mean, you could almost say he was the protege of Antonio Inoki. And when you're talking about, like, the founding fathers of New Japan, which is obviously the biggest wrestling company in Japan now, he's considered to be one of the founding members of the whole promotion. And it hadn't been founded all that long before this. So we're talking about like one of the pillars that the promotion was built on, wrestling the biggest star from the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously, you know, two very, very big stars with two very important championships. Actually, kind of three very important championships. And I guess we can get into that a little bit. Flair, of course, was longtime NWA champion many times throughout mm-hmm. the 80s. As the rise of WWE happened, then basically the NWA dwindled down to the point where it almost ceased to exist, except for WCW essentially was the last territory in it. There were a handful of smaller ones, but they weren't relevant on the national landscape. It was basically the NWA and WCW were synonymous with each other. But
right.
after Ted Turner bought Jim Crockett Promotions, also WCW, bought it in late 88 into early 89. WCW slowly emphasized the WCW initials and de-emphasized the NWA ones. And in early 91, when Flair won the title back after Sting sort of flopped in 1990, they created their own titles, their own world title and their own tag titles. But that wasn't really like something that was publicly acknowledged. They just sort of – but basically they changed the name to the WCW world title and sort of created it. But Flair was just known as the world champion. Anyone watching this would have thought it was one title, but it was really two titles. It was the NWA title, and it was also this new title that WCW had created.
Right.
So, and that becomes important a little bit in this match, but really after – this with how things go down with Flair just a couple months after that, which we can get into sort of after we talk about the match. But so we have Fujinami come out first. We have Flair come out with a series of girls in one-piece bathing suits, which is just sort of an odd choice. Like, it just seems like they should be at the beach instead of in the Tokyo Dome accompanying, like, Ric Flair. Like, they're not even, like, at all, like, alluring. They're just, like...
Right. They're flesh-colored, too. I don't get the idea.
Yeah, they look like, you know, like my mom would have looked like at the time, you know. it's just sort of a strange choice, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe sexy was different back in 1991. It's hard to say. I was 12 then, so I kind of remember it being, you know, a little different. But whatever.
I do want to point out that my favorite part of the whole match is that when Ric Flair comes out, he walks over to the stairs that he has to walk down, pulls up his robe like a dress, and then daintily walks down the stairs.
Yes, he does do that indeed. Yes. I also enjoy the surfer haircut he has here.
Oh yeah.
Like he cut it where it's short in the back, but he still is sort of wavy in the front, like, you know, was sort of popular at the time. It's a strange haircut on him. It was good that he got rid of it, but I think I do, if I recall correctly, WCW forced or, you know, asked him to get that haircut to sort of, you know, to be cool, I guess. You know, they're trying to sort of tweak him a little bit so that he would be less Ric Flair, and so they would, you know, so that they could be hipping with the kids and all that, and the rap music, and, you know, and that sort of thing. But, you know, like many such efforts in WCW didn't quite work out.
Oh man, so they told him to get rid of the mullet, but nobody told Shawn Michaels that for another 6 years. That's
no, sad. Well, yeah, that is sort of a strange phenomenon. Like they really like. WWF wrestlers held on to those mullets pretty tight for like a long time. Like basically all the Click, maybe not so much Hunter, but you know, the rest of the guys, they pretty much all were rocking those mullets into 96 or maybe even some of them into 97. So,
and yeah. You know, they'd still probably all be doing it today.
They probably would. Yeah. Well, you know, wrestlers had those fanny packs forever too, you know?
Oh yeah. So. And the Zubaz that stayed on a good 10 years after that phenomenon blew over.
Right. Right. So, you know, let's not suggest that wrestling has ever really necessarily been good at keeping up with the times. So we have Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone on commentary here, and they go over the rules quite a bit, a lot, where this is sort of like a hybrid between the typical NWA style rules and the Japanese style. They keep the Japanese 20 count outs, but they have the over the top rule, the over the top disqualification rule, which, by the way, has pretty much always been a stupid rule.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Like, I get it because I think like I think it would be a better rule if it wasn't always used as like a cheap finish. Like if it was used like as a wow, that guy got thrown over the top rope and now he's out for, you know, 4 weeks because going over the top rope is this really devastating thing and like he really hurt him bad and ooh, that's that dastardly guy, you know, as opposed to like, oh, this guy accidentally threw this guy over the top rope, so it's a disqualification, so the title change doesn't count.
Right, and it always seemed like the kind of stipulation that would have worked really great with, like, Andre the Giant, who is so great in Battle Royals that you get him in a regular match and he can't throw you over the top rope. But that's not even who they used it for. They used it on Ric Flair. I, Why would he even throw people over the top rope?
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, it was just one of those things where it was always used in such a cheap way where, like, the way it could have been effective failed because it just was always synonymous with, oh, groan, another, you know, crappy finish.
Yep.
And I think count on disqualifications like that a lot, too. Like, you rarely see those done well to the point where you don't feel cheated out of getting a result of a match.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I've never seen a count-out finish ever that made me happy it was a count-out finish.
I would say the Mark Henry Sheamus one at SummerSlam was pretty good.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Yeah. You have to kill the guy, and then he's dead for 10 seconds.
Right, exactly. There's a really good Pat Patterson, Sergeant Slaughter one from 81 in WWF. Where Slaughter's the heel and Patterson's like the babyface, and like you have Patterson keeps trying to climb onto the ring and he's bleeding, and then Slaughter's like really, really intensely like punching him down, and eventually he like punches him off the apron, and then Patterson's countered out. That one's pretty swell too.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So, but yes, usually not so good. And they sort of, I mean, you know, they get into a little bit of, you know, kind of the Japanese crowds are different. They don't really get too much into like the, you know, the kind of unfortunate stereotypes that people might have about Japanese, you know, just like always being honorable. Not that that's like a negative stereotype, but that's also, but it's obviously a stereotype that very much puts people in a box, which is still bad. So they don't really get into that too much, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah, and I actually really appreciate Jim Ross's way of doing it. Like, the pay-per-view opens, and Jim Ross is immediately there like, listen, their crowds are going to be different. If they're not cheering, don't freak out. They care about the match. They're just respectful. I mean, they really laid it out for the fans instead of just letting them be like, wow, I guess everybody hates this show.
Right, yeah, which is, of course, a good way to do it. I didn't see the whole show, but I thought for this match, Ross and Schiavone were really effective together on commentary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Schiavone has always worked better as sort of a color commentary guy. He's so dry with play-by-play, but with Jim Ross there to do it, I mean, when he came in, it was really more effective.
Yeah, yeah. And they did a nice job of getting into strategy throughout the match. And, Jim Ross shared a story about meeting Ric Flair like the night before and Flair being sort of subdued and, you know, really focused on the match and being more serious than he normally was.
Yeah.
And then talking about how Flair had studied some videotape of Fujinami and thought he was susceptible to the Flair chops, which is kind of silly thinking about it because it's not like Ric Flair's ever had a match where he didn't use the Flair chop, but at least like, okay, yeah, all right. That's at least you're getting into something there that has a little bit of depth. That's pretty cool. You know?
And that would be such a comical thing to, like, actual Japanese wrestling fans watching. Because, I mean, you know, Japanese wrestling is so much stiffer. And, I mean, Fujinami, part of his whole deal was, I mean, you can't knock him out. He's just a tough old man. So
right. Yeah.
I don't know why they came up with he's susceptible to Flair's chops for some reason.
Yeah. And they focus, look at the chest. It's going to get red. It's like, well, yeah, the chest pretty much gets red most matches. But all right. You know, at least they're trying, you know. Even if you could pick it apart a little bit, hey, they're making an effort. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I mean, really, what else does Ric Flair do? I mean, he's got to be susceptible to something.
Right, yeah. I mean, Ric Flair, he does chops, he works the knee, and he does suplexes, and he goes to the top and gets tossed off, you know? So that's pretty much all he does. And it works. He's one of the greatest of all time, so, you know. But, yeah, if you break it down to what he does, it really isn't that much. It really is, like, he keeps it pretty basic and simple and is, you know, done the same, you know, 12 things for 40 years.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's damn good at it.
Right, right. So, Bill Alfonso is the referee.
It's the greatest.
Yeah, yeah. You know, of course, later of ECW fame as manager to Sabu and Rob Van Dam and being very annoying with the whistle and so on and so forth. But he was a regular referee for quite a few years. Now, was he mostly in Japan at this point or...
I think he was a WCW referee.
Okay. All right. Because I know he did WWE for a while, like in 93-ish or so.
Right.
But, I wasn't watching a whole lot during this period, so I wasn't, you know, I've gone back and seen things, but he wasn't a guy I really knew then, so.
Right. Yeah.
But they mentioned that he has a lot of experience in Japan, so that's sort of part of the storyline in the book. And he really does get, like, involved. Like, he gets physically involved, like, you know, trying to, you know, keep Flair away from Fujinami. And he does some things where he's more aggressive than referees generally are, it seems.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny because he's not remembered as a referee now because of his managing stuff. But in this, he does a really great job of understanding both styles. So when, I mean, Fujinami needs to be backed off, I mean, he understands when to do that because obviously Fujinami doesn't speak any English. So he does a really great job in this match.
Yeah, yeah. So they both have black trunks and boots. Fujinami has no knee pads. Start off by feeling each other out. Fujinami gets him down with a really hard shoulder block. Ross puts over both that they have really good cardio earlier, that they're, you know, they both can go for a very long time, that they both, you know, and also that Fujinami likes to start fast, you know, he likes to really, you know, be aggressive and so forth. You know Fujinami better than I do. Do you think that's the case? You know, was he more of just kind of a relentless you know, speedy guy, or is that just was just convenient for the match story?
He isn't so much speedy, but he was always billed as being very agile.
I guess relentless is more of a word I was going
for. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
He was always seen as more of like a relentless, put submissions on you until you break down kind of wrestler.
Okay, yeah. So, he reminds me a bit of Ron Garvin here as far as just the style and the way that Flair and he have, you know, like chop and slap and punch exchanges and kind of the structure of the match. And just Fujinami physically is pretty similar to Garvin, too, and works maybe not quite as stiff because Garvin was really stiff, although Fujinami – I don't know if he's less stiff with Flair than he normally would be. It's certainly possible, but you know, it's a physical stiff style.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's one of the less stiff guys from that era, especially from having learned from Inoki. But yeah, he's actually pretty easy on Flair in this match.
Yeah, I thought so as well. I mean, you know, certainly it's tight work, but it's not like really, you know. You know, like, oh, like, wow, amazingly, you know, stiff. You know, I don't see that much. There's a couple of hard clotheslines and things like that. But, you know, so Flair eventually works a side headlock, gets sent into the ropes, but then gets a shoulder block. Then Fujinami gets a back suplex out of nowhere, and then he locks in the dragon sleeper. We're about like 3 to 4 minutes in, and the fans go pretty nuts when they see it. Flair struggles in it for a little bit, then eventually gets to the ropes. So, yeah. Kind of a quick, you know, sign that, ooh, Fujinami can, you know, get Flair here if he's not careful, and Flair has to kind of slow it down and, you know, work more back his game.
Right, and I do want to say, Fujinami's the guy who invented both the Dragon Sleeper and the Dragon Suplex. So that's why the fans go so crazy, is those are his moves. That's his finisher.
Right, yeah, and he's referred to as the dragon, you know, Tatsumi the Dragon Fujinami here as well. So,
right.
I have always loved the Dragon Sleeper. It's one of my favorite, really isn't used that much moves, and I don't really know why.
Right. I've never been able to figure it out either. I mean, you grab it around their neck and you just wrench back like you're ripping their head off. It looks fantastic.
Right. Yeah. And it's not, I don't think it's particularly like dangerous or like, you know, it would be like a move where somebody, you know, would be like, oh, I don't want to do that. You know, I always thought Scott Steiner should have done the Dragon Sleeper instead of the Steiner Recliner.
Well, you would actually feel like Steiner could actually rip their head off.
Exactly. Right. It was perfect. But, you know, I don't get paid to make suggestions. So.
Yep.
Oh, well. So then we have Flair is able to sucker him in a little bit, works him over in the corner. They trade blows, and then Fujinami gets a quick hip toss and a drop kick. Flair again bails, and he walks around the ring for a little bit. Eventually he goes back in. Fujinami works a headlock for a bit. Tony talks a little bit, and I think makes a good point here about how the WCW guys were doing well. He mentioned the Steiners had won a match earlier to win both the IWGP tag titles. I believe they were WCW tag champions as well. And So, and despite the fact that they would have had a long plane trip and would have dealt with the jet lag, they said, I think it was a 16-hour flight, including a layover in Seattle. And then Ross said that, well, he thinks that the crowd energy of the Tokyo Dome probably kept them going throughout the match, but that they would be worn out during the trip back. So I like that little insight, bringing in that, like, the reality stuff in there.
Right.
It just works well with the story.
And I have to imagine that at the time when this happened, I mean, if you're watching this, it's like a whole new world for you. So learning all of this stuff, I mean, now we know so much about Japanese wrestling, but it had to have been so unique and crazy and mysterious that...
Yeah, absolutely. Flair eventually gets him into the corner, and more chops and punches, which are used quite often in this match, as you might expect. We get a whip into the ropes and a back body drop by Fujinami, but then Flair immediately gets a belly to back suplex. He misses a chop off the ropes and sort of oddly dodges a Fujinami clothesline. I think it was a mistiming, but they covered it well anyway. And then Fujinami misses a... he does sort of like a... He does this drop kick where he's like, he falls flat on his back instead of going off to his side.
Right.
So always sort of been a... I've always thought that drop kick looks strange to me. I don't know. I mean, probably just because I'm used to the drop kick, but Bret Hart did a similar drop kick.
Yeah.
I always thought it was sort of strange.
Yeah, it always kind of looks like they're just taking a back bump and you don't even notice that they're actually kicking the guy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and probably also because they missed those drop kicks a lot. I don't know how Fujinami did with his, but Bret missed his, I think, more than he hit his. If I recall correctly, yeah. Wasn't quite as bad as Flair off the top, but it was, near that level. So, after Fujinami misses the drop kick, then Flair drapes the leg on the rope and drops down. Then he attacks the knee for a while, gets a snapmare for a couple of two counts. Then he drops the knee, sort of grazes Fujinami's head, but not. I couldn't tell if he grazed it or didn't even hit it at all. But Ross calls it as a miss.
He got his hair. If anything, he got the hair.
Right, right. So I like that Ross calls it as a miss and doesn't pretend that he hit it. Fujinami's then able to get the Scorpion Deathlock Sharpshooter. I don't know if they had a name for it or not, but of course Ross mentions that Sting has held him on this match for has held him in this hold for quite a while, so Flair's used to it, but he struggles to get out of it. Fujinami just sort of transitions into into like an Indian Deathlock and then a modified STF for a bit. And then sort of goes into a camel clutch very briefly, and then into a sleeper, and then Flair gets out of it. So he tries a bunch of those moves kind of quickly. None of them quite work all that well.
Yep. I don't have anything super to add. That was big Fujinami's deal, and that's actually kind of where Samoa Joe later got his deal, where he'd quickly go in between submission moves, as Fujinami would do that, trying to figure out, which one he could get the best grip on. And then if you could get through that, I mean, you would get out, because you didn't have it locked totally in.
Okay. All right. Cool. I wasn't sure. I'm so used to you lock the submission, and then you either get to the ropes, or cause them to submit, or occasionally it's reversed, but... the different submissions, it's just not a psychology I'm used to, I guess.
Right.
But it makes sense. So, because, you would think you would think that it would be hard to hold a guy in the sharpshooter for very long. Because,
right.
You're lifting, you have to stay on your legs, you have to bend down. I mean, it's hard to keep that position for a long time, so the guy's not submitting. It makes sense to get something where you're not putting as much pressure on yourself.
Yeah, and then when if Flair tries to get out of the sharpshooter, you can sort of use his momentum to get into a different move, so he's never totally out until he finally gets out.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So Flair tries the chop off the ropes, and this time Fujinami is able to land the clothesline that he missed earlier, which gets two. And Flair is limping a bit at this point. He is able to get another snapmare and goes to the top, which Tony even questions the logic of why Flair is going to the top. If Tony Schiavone's questioning your logic, then you really need to be wondering what you're doing. And although Fujinami tries to throw him off, like we would expect, but Flair actually drops down to the apron and then snaps his neck on the ropes. Then they go outside for a bit. Flair tosses him over the barricade, and then he drops his knee on the ropes as he tries to get in. Yells at Alfonso to keep his mouth shut. Ross thinks that Alfonso will be leaning on the rules, and it kind of explains what's going on the outside. Obviously, it's a big match. You want to have a winner, so on and so forth.
Right.
And Fujinami's sort of frustrated outside because Flair's not really, letting him in. Finally, he makes it in. He gets a bit fired up, gets a lot of slaps and chops. Sends Flair in the corner, but then he runs into the knee when he's getting up there. Flair gets a neck breaker for two. Then lands the knee drop he missed before. Then he gets a butterfly suplex for two. And then a nice little delayed vertical suplex. I don't recall. I mean, Flair would sort of delay sometimes, but I don't recall him ever holding it for quite that long. But he's slow to cover and is only able to get two off of it.
Yeah, and I didn't even know that he could do that. I mean, I never thought of Ric Flair as a particularly strong guy. But, I mean, I always wonder what kind of things he had in his repertoire that he just didn't do and only pulled out in really special matches like this. And that's one of those things.
Right, exactly. As I mentioned before, Flair jawing with Alfonso a bit, and Ross mentions that that's one of signs that Flair is frustrated, that he'll talk more when he gets mad, and you can sort of tell that he is. He works him over for a bit with some chops and punches in the corner, and you can see the Fujinami's chest getting more bruised. Then eventually Fujinami fights back a bit. Flair gets an eye rake, then goes back to the top. And then the result that you would expect happens.
Right.
And he gets thrown off the top.
I don't know how he could be considered the best wrestler in the world. And I don't know why on commentary they didn't bring this up more often. But, I mean, he's the best wrestler in the world. And yet in every single match, he tries at least twice to come off the top rope. And it never, ever works.
Well,
why would that not factor in?
Well, it's hubris. You know, it's like, you know, he just has, like, you know, he's just such a strong belief in himself that he can do it, that, you know, it's like this time it's going to happen. It's like Charlie Brown in the football, you know?
Right. And I loved when he finally, in WWE one time, I saw that he finally hit it and he jumped off the top and it was like the weakest karate chop of all time. Like he finally got up there to do it and didn't know what exactly he had been trying to do for so many years.
Right. I mean, I've seen him land it, you know, at least probably like a dozen times, but, you know, that's a very small amount out of, you know, all the times he's done. I mean, usually you get either he does, yeah, the karate chop that's a little bit weak, or he does a body press. Those are kind of the two things he'll do off the top. So
right.
He's won a couple of titles with the body presses, so let's give him that. He beat Race and he beat Garvin, I think. So, you know.
That's a good one.
Yeah. So we have Flair tossed into the corner, does the flip, and then gets drop kicked off the apron. Then Fujinami goes out and he rams his face pretty hard in the rail a few times. Flair's bleeding at this point. We head back into the ring, and then Fujinami punches him repeatedly in the forehead to enhance the bleeding. He does the Flair flop, but he walks much further across the ring than he normally does to do the flop.
Right.
Like, usually it's two or three steps in a flop, but this is like a six or seven step flop.
Yeah, he comes just short of, like, doing the Flair strut across the ring and then doing the flop. I mean, he's just, like, wandering all the way back to America before he does it.
Right. Which I don't think I've ever seen. I don't think I've ever seen the strut and then flop combination.
That'd be an amazing combination.
Do you think, you know, yeah, you would think that would have happened at some point, but no. You know, what can you do? And then Flair does get back up. He manages to catch Fujinami's foot, but Fujinami hits him a really good enziguri, which totally gets over. The crowd pops big for. I believe Ross mentions that that's Inoki's, you know, one of Inoki's famous moves as well. Okay. So, and Flair now begs off. He's bloody. He's beaten pretty bad. And Fujinami gets a back body drop and a clothesline for two. And Flair gets some more chops. Fujinami drapes himself on the ropes. Flair pushes Alfonso out of the way as he's trying to, you know, give, obviously do a rope break. They trade blows again. Fujinami blocks a Flair punch and then just wails him really hard and then wails him again with another punch. And then Flair goes down and it's just like a really like fierce punch and it gets, you know, a giant reaction.
Right. And I mean, yeah, in Japan at the time, like everything was stiff. I mean, it didn't get really stiff until King's Road in All Japan in the 90s. Uh-huh. But I mean, back then, like, you do like three or four really stiff shots a match and the people would come alive for it. Like, holy crap, he knocked the hell out of that guy.
Right. And it was great. I mean, it was really, really well done. And the timing of it was perfect too, you know, to really hit him hard like that right in his big comeback, you know?
Right.
So, Flair does another flip in the turnbuckle, but he doesn't do all the flip all the way over. He sort of gets stuck in the tree of woe. He falls out of it, and then Fujinami gets a cradle roll up for basically 2 3/4.
Right.
Flair pushes him out, and then Fujinami gets a back suplex for two, but the feet are on the ropes. Flair bails again out of the ring, but Fujinami goes after him. They trade blows outside for a bit. They go back in, and Flair comes off the ropes on the run, goes for a forearm. Fujinami ducks, and Flair nails Alfonso with it, who goes crumbling to the floor. Really, really great. Really great ref bump.
Yeah, it's one of the great ref bumps of all time. He like totally ragdolls and just collapses like he has no bones.
Yeah, we just we're recording this not long after the Extreme Rules Brock Lesnar and John Cena match. And that had a similar bump with Charles Robinson involved. And this was in that league. You know, this was really, really, really good. So, so then we have Fujinami gets a couple of, you know, roll-ups and visual pinfalls. The crowd, you know, even chants three at one point. Then Flair comes and charges him while he's on the ropes. And then he backdrops Flair off the ropes. They make a big note that, of course, this would be disqualification. They show Taiga Hattori, another referee, and some other New Japan wrestlers who are out there in white jackets trying to help revive Alfonso. Flair gets back up to the apron. Fujinami suplexes him in. Hattori goes in, and then Fujinami gets a guillotine roll-up for the 1-2-3, and that's, of course, the victory, and we get a giant reaction and celebration.
Right. And, yeah, that was such a big deal, too, because the only American title that the Japanese people knew about at the time was the NWA title, now the WCW title. So, I mean, that was like him winning, like, the Olympics for them.
Yeah, and the NWA title it had been won by Japanese wrestlers before, usually for a very brief time. Giant Baba had it, you know. I guess Baba was really the only Japanese wrestler that had it before this. I'm trying to think if anyone else did. Inoki, of course, had the WWF belt, but
right. I think it was just Baba, yeah. But I mean, it goes all the way back to when Riki Dozan was having like the most watched things in the history of Japanese television against Lou Fez for the NWA title.
I mean, right. Exactly. Yeah. So that was a title with obviously high esteem.
Right.
Yeah. So we kind of get Ross and Giovanni in the commentary. They make sort of a big deal about the fact that they believe that Flair should have been disqualified, make a big thing about Alfonso being the only referee of record, which sets up the controversy that would lead to a rematch at Super Brawl in May. And then so we have a big celebration. Fujinami is holding both belts. He's draped on the wrestler's shoulders. He gets a big trophy. And then we cut to a very cheap-looking press conference. We have Fujinami up on a podium. We have a couple of people I think are at a table sitting down next to him, and then we have a bunch of people wearing white jackets. They look like wrestlers. I'll see there. I don't even see any media in this press conference. It looks like it's basically just Jim Ross, and he's getting into the fact that it was controversial. Then we have Flair storm in, flanked by Arn Anderson and Barry Windham. He takes back the belt. He yells about how it's his belt, and he's, if you want it, come to America to get it. And then Fujinami says a couple of words in English to Ross, with the gist of it being, I don't know why he took the belt, blah blah. That was basically it.
And I do want to comment that the random guys who are standing up there are like the young boys from the promotion who like carry his bags and like hand him towels and stuff after the thing.
Right.
And also that this wasn't just a press conference set up for this random angle, though I'm sure it seemed that way to a lot of people. But after every major Japanese wrestling show, they do like these little stage press conferences afterwards. And there are actually reporters there that are from like the random media organizations and stuff. It's become sort of like a weird thing now. Back then, those were actually like after basketball game press conferences.
Yeah.
And to have Ric Flair run in with like the bandage around his head, like he's the Karate Kid, and just steal
yes.
and run off.
Right.
Yeah.
It was that was cool. I mean, that definitely had like I like the idea of post. Like I always feel like they should do that at WrestleMania. They should do like a post WrestleMania press conference. Like I feel like that's like a big, that would be like a.
Right.
Where it would you could tell stories at those venues as long as you didn't do it all the time, And I know they did it sometimes in Japan. They didn't do it all the time, but there were I've seen other instances where they would do an angle at a press conference, whether it was after a show or heading into a show. That's a cool thing. I think the lack of any of what appeared to be any media there was what threw me off on, what made it seem like, there weren't any reporters there. So how much of a press conference could it really be? But yeah, I obviously those did really happen. And wrestling was covered in the Japanese media like a real, with like the type of attention that a real sport would get, like a real major league sport would get, like NFL football, basically.
Exactly right.
So I don't know if that's really the case now, because I think wrestling's sort of dwindled in the cultural landscape. But I mean, I know it's still important in Japan, but it's not as important as it was at this point, I don't think.
Yeah, at this point, it would have been like the NFL is now. I mean, these days, it's sort of like hockey is. I mean, if there's nothing else going on, or it's in the back of the newspaper, that sort of thing.
Right. Which isn't bad. I mean, hockey's still a national sport, but it's not, it doesn't have the same cultural awareness, certainly, that it used to. So
exactly.
Yeah. So this was the first of the WCW New Japan Super Shows. I think they had was it three in all? Yeah, they had three in all. So this one was taped in March of 91 and then shown in April of 91. So there wasn't really much of a lag time between that. The other ones were for the Tokyo Jones, like they have an annual show, and they still have a January 4th show at the Tokyo Dome, and those were a few months ahead of time. Now that wasn't really that important, even in 92, 93, because the internet really was not, it was in its infancy, and spoilers weren't a huge issue like they would be today. Although I don't think the 92, 93 versions of this were really important for storyline purposes for WCW like this one was.
Right, and not even close, I would say.
Yeah, because this obviously led to the Super Brawl 1 match, the rematch between Fujinami and Flair, where Flair regains the title. And And then, yeah, there was really no other storyline consequences for the the other ones. But definitely, unique show for the time, for sure. As you mentioned, the atmosphere and all that sort of thing. And it's, I know I've seen the Steiners match before. I think I've seen the Muda Flair match. I'm not sure if I've seen anything else from this show, but I should check it out someday because it's definitely, some cool stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it feels like such a significant show too, aside from the Gigante match, but Gigante versus Big Cat, that's
oh stupid. Yeah, well, it was only 2 minutes, so
yeah, it's just a face palmed at the end. But this really, it's a special show, and I think ultimately it wound up being a more special show for Japan than it was for America, because I mean, I don't think it did like huge numbers for WCW or anything like that. But I think it opened the door to Japan for American wrestling fans, similarly to the AAA WCW show would do later in the 90s.
Right. And the New Japan relationship was pretty important to WCW, throughout the 90s. I mean, even in the NWO era. I mean, they imported a lot of Japanese talent, and they had a lot of, great wrestlers. Jushin Liger, obviously, they bring Muda back every once in a while, guys like that, Tenzan and Chono and, so on and so forth. So, yeah. I mean, they did a lot of, and the relationship, they had a lot of those guys could work Japan as well. That relationship also was important in, Eddie Guerrero, Benoit, Chris Jericho, Dean Malenko, all wrestling in WCW as well.
Absolutely.
So, that be not just an influx of the Japanese talent, but a lot of the American talent that became very important in the 90s and 2000s too. So, those guys weren't necessarily main eventers, but those guys were really important part of building a reputation for WCW of having, up and down great TV and pay-per-views that I think attracted fans just as much, or was certainly an important factor in them being as popular as they were for a long time.
Right. And I always like to go back to the point that, I mean, Scott Norton, who was as much of a nobody in WCW as there's possible to be, was one of the biggest American stars of all time in Japan. And it just made WCW's roster look so incredible, especially in that country, that like their best wrestlers and the top guys are like mid-carders in WCW. They can't even get a match with Hogan, sort of thing.
Right, right, which is an interesting way to spin that. But yeah, that's cool. It just, it was a special time, obviously. So
yeah.
I mean, I know this is totally against WWE's mindset, but it would just be neat if they were willing to have, incorporate international talent more and have, a co-promotion with, a Japanese company or Mexican company or whatever. I mean, TNA does it, but had some benefits, but that doesn't really,
TNA doesn't much in their landscape. Guys, they send them. I mean, they sent them Okada and Tanahashi, and they were just like, yeah, you can be on Explosion.
Right,
so,
yeah.
I don't even see the point.
Well, and WWE, I mean, they had a relationship with New Japan for a long time. We too. I mean, in the early 80s,
right.
And then they would bring in international talent every once in a while, So, I mean, they had an openness to do that through, a lot of the 80s and in some periods in the 90s. And then, they just sort of became a lot more narrow in their thinking as far as, how they want to present their wrestling, which has its benefits as well. But I just think the more different styles you can kind of showcase and the more diversity you can have, I think the more interesting in the shows you present will be.
I definitely agree. Absolutely.
Well, good. Well, anything else you think we should talk about here?
I did want to point out one thing. I don't think that, I don't want to speak as like the big Puro guy here, but I think that when American wrestling fans watch events like this, especially when they're so old, it's hard to realize that there were no characters like Ric Flair in Japan. I mean, prior to this, they had never seen a character like that before. Like the cocky, arrogant guy, like the rich guy and everything like that. That's not something that existed in Japanese wrestling. So this match would have seemed like it's probably, as far as from how the story was booked sort of standpoint, it's actually really similar to Flair Steamboat, in that like Fujinami is like the hometown guy, clean cut, we know him, we love him, and in comes this arrogant American jerk, and I wish our guy would kill him. I mean, it was really like that. And that can sort of get lost over the years and across countries. But I just wanted to make it clear that Ric Flair was 100% complete shock to those people. He had to have been.
Yeah. Well, Flair had wrestled there, you know, quite a bit throughout the 80s. So, I mean, he was a known commodity in Japan. But yeah, I mean, obviously the Japanese, you know, the style of characters, that was not something that was, you know, as your point absolutely is well taken. But that was kind of what Japan was built on. I mean, it was built on, like, you know, Japanese hometown heroes beating American stereotypes in a way, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, and when obviously American wrestling was built on that too, with, you know, clean cut Americans beating, you know, foreign stereotypes, or either. If it wasn't built on that, that was certainly a major element, you know, in the 40s and 50s as it rose on television. And that was something they went to a lot. So it's funny how, I mean, because, you know, Ricky Dozan was the national hero who fought, you know, like a guy like Freddie Blassie, you know, who,
right.
You know, you know, had the blonde hair, and, you know, he was a different character than Flair, but he certainly, you know, shared a few of the flamboyant elements. But yeah, I mean, right. Flair was certainly very distinctive, you know, and so forth, which, you know, served. I mean, he was distinctive in American wrestling too, but yeah, but even more so in Japanese wrestling, I'm sure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
I find it so funny that, like, the same guys would be like, Ricky Dozan would face Luthes, and Luthes would be the dastardly American heel, and then Ricky Dozan would come over to America, and then he'd be the dastardly Japanese heel. They just have the same match, they just switch sides.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's funny, and when you think about it, it's, you know, obviously, you know, I don't really encourage, it's not fun to play on national stereotypes. We're, you know, hopefully we move past that, but it, you know, it's sort of like an archaic, like, oh, you know, you just how amusing it is how wrestling evolved and all, like, the politically incorrect things that wrestling did through many, many years. I mean, you know, at least it's right. The colorful history is interesting, and, you know, kind of something you could chuckle at.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, well, why don't you let everyone know a little bit about Qish Reviews and anything else you want to mention?
Qish Reviews is the wrestling blog I run with my best friend Vice and my wife, Mrs. Qish. And it's at qishreviews.blogspot.com. That's C-E-U-C-E-W-S-H. I misspell that every time I say it. It's my own website, and I never spell it right. CEWSHreviews.blogspot.com. And I mean, we just have a lot of fun with WWE shows and foreign shows, and we try to cover everything and have a good time being humorous about it, everything like that.
Yep, and it's a very enjoyable site. I definitely encourage everyone to check it out. And you're on Twitter as well.
Yep, and that's Qish Reviews, again, CEWSH, on Twitter. And I mean, where I'm friends with Jason here and pretty much everybody else of any interest.
Yeah, so definitely a good thing to check out. Always good conversation about wrestling with you. I always enjoy your point of view and enjoy having good, healthy debates and discussions about issues. So if you're into Twitter, also, as you probably know, but if you don't, follow me at WrestleSpective and check Fair to Flair as well. And I'm also now writing for CagesideSeats.com, so definitely check out what things I'm writing at CagesideSeats.com. So everyone, again, thanks for listening. Glad to be back after a little hiatus, and we'll be back with another show for you as soon as possible.